This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Con Fringe reading series. Okay, welcome back everybody to the final part of this Bristol Con Fringe, and as you may have noticed, we have sprouted a pile of books on the table. I'll have more to say about them at the moment, but I need to tell you that Jonathan only has one copy of Carter and Lovecraft left because people have been molesting him and forcing money upon him. So if anybody desperately wants it, speak now or forever hold your peace. If you change your mind later, I'm sure that a certain store in Clifton Triangle will be getting copies in, won't they, Des? Yes, on Thursday. Okay, so the usual format for the final session is that we get to ask our readers some awkward, interesting, entertaining, or embarrassing questions. And I get to start because I have the microphone. I'm going to start with Joe. Joe, the Spark and Carousel book is based in a fantasy world that you've set a number of other novels in. I believe you've been working on it for quite a while, so could you tell us a little bit about that?
The actual world is my sandpit, and I've been playing in it since I was about 14. So, yeah, it's a standalone novel, but it is set in an ongoing fantasy world, so there are references in the book to things that have happened in previous books that may have a bearing on this book but don't actually impact on the story, so you can read it on your own there on sale on the table. Just thought I'd mention it. So it takes place around the same time as the events of the previous two novels, The Art of Forgetting Ones, but it doesn't actually have very much crossover with them at all. But there are characters in it who were in previous books, and there are probably characters in it who will be in future books, and it's all just like a little ongoing thing, and there's little treats in there for ongoing readers.
Alrighty, now one of the things that you're quite well known for is being cruel to your characters and whatever, but one of them seems to have got her own back this time. I mean, when I was reading it, I did feel quite sorry for Alarise originally with her parents marrying her off to this trader as a fourth wife. And then she goes and murders her father and turns him into a puppet. She's a nasty piece of work, isn't she?
She's absolutely horrible. She was enormous fun to write. And yes, it was at first you think, oh, poor woman, she's having a terrible time. And then she does such awful things throughout the book that by the end of it, you're just longing for her to get her comeuppance, because she unleashes a demon army which threatened to take over the world, and she does it just for the hell of it because she's horrible. So she was great fun.
Although one of the things that interests me about her is that, unlike most evil overlords, she doesn't start out being really good at everything. She's actually like finding her way around and sort of experimenting with stuff, and as you say, just doing stuff for the hell of it.
Yeah, I mean, I've never had any truck with the notion that evil people are just evil because they're evil. You know, that's something that was prevalent in fantasy, you know, in the 70s, if you like, and it doesn't have any bearing on the way people really behave. You know, nobody stands there and goes, I am Lord Evil and I will take over the world because I am evil. Everybody thinks that they're the hero of their own story. So she obviously thinks that what she's doing is, while fairly horrible, is perfectly justified because it will get her what she wants. And she's a terribly self-centred person.
Hey, you might not want to take over the world, but in the evil overlord, we have rules. The characters that we heard about in the extract that you read, Lord Carey and his family, they're important characters in the book, but they're not the title characters. Spark and Carousel are actually people in the book, so could you tell us a little bit about who they are?
Yeah, Spark and Carousel are street names. Nobody in the Cape Carey underworld goes by their real name. They all go by street names. Spark is a runaway teenager who was raised by a mage. So he has all this magic that he's been taught, but that he hasn't actually learned to control. And he's running away from a number of things, which I can't say because of spoilers. So he finds himself in the city, like fizzing with magic that is causing him to blow things up and set fire to things, and no idea what to do with it. And he then falls into the clutches of one of the many underworld gangs who think that they can use his magic for their own advantage. And Carousel is a wire walker and a junior pickpocket who kind of takes him under her wing and looks after him and tries to help him come to terms with his magic and survive in the big scary city.
Okay, thank you very much, Joe. I'll now move on to Jonathan. Now, the title of the book is a bit of a giveaway, really. But if anybody mentions Lovecraft, and obviously you've got a tentacle on the cover of the book, so I think despite the fact that nothing was actually said during the couple of chapters you read, that we kind of guessed that there must be something a little eldritch going on. But there were other clues as well for those of us who are as steeped in Lovecraftiana as I am. One of which, of course, is that the opening chapter is set in Red Hook, which is the part of New York where Lovecraft lived briefly when he married Sonia Green and went to New York and got all upset about the number of foreigners who lived there. So I guess the first question that comes to mind is the building in which Carter and Hammond track down the serial killer the actual building in which Lovecraft lived?
No.
That's kind of a shame because it's been in the news recently. It was actually for sale, and there were a lot of people who were very keen to buy the home of H.P. Lovecraft. But there you go, never mind. But you also kind of gave it away in the titles of the chapters because they appear to all be based on Lovecraft stories.
Yes, that was a lot of fun, actually. Every chapter in the book is either named after one of Lovecraft's stories or novellas or poems in places, or is a paraphrase of one. So the one chapter, for example, instead of being called The Thing on the Doorstep, is called The Thing and the Doorstep. So that kind of carry on.
Now, because you've told us a little bit about the book beforehand, I happen to know that the Lovecraft in the title is not actually H.P. himself, but a relative. So could you explain to us how Detective Carter manages to get mixed up in all this Lovecraftian stuff?
After what happens in Red Hook, Carter's had enough of the police and he resigns and takes up as a private detective instead. And then one day, a lawyer turns up and says, "Congratulations, a will's been read and you've come into possession of some property." And he goes, "Oh, that's nice." And it's up in Providence, which is, of course, the other town that's heavily associated with Lovecraft. And he goes up there and finds that he's actually come into possession of a fully functioning business, a bookstore. And the place is run by one Emily Lovecraft, who is a heavily fictional great-great-great-granddaughter, grand-niece, of H.P. Lovecraft.
I was going to say, Howard and Sonia wouldn't have done anything like that, surely. I don't think Howard could have coped with that. Dear. Yes. Anyway, so Carter then moves up to Providence and presumably gets involved in the sort of things that happen in Providence, which we all know much too well. The other thing I wanted to ask you is that this book came about in an interesting way, and it will, I believe, be turning into a television series shortly. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was a bit bizarre. I actually came across my notes for this the other day. It was January last year. The Johannes Cabal books are published by Thomas Dunn Books, which is sort of an imprint of an imprint, for Macmillan US. And the Cabal books touch quite heavily on the Cthulhu mythos. And Macmillan's apparently got a section which consists of a bloke who trots around the West Coast hassling producers in lifts and things and saying, "I've got this awesome idea," and it goes more or less like this, and the producer goes, "No," and he goes, "Yeah, you're right, it's rubbish, but I've got this other one here." And if they say, "Oh, that sounds interesting," he says, "Oh, we've got exactly the right writer for this," and then they get back in touch and it comes around. So this was actually a work for hire. I don't own the copyright on this. Macmillan does, which is peculiar. It was straight, but then again, I used to be in the games industry and I was used to not owning my own intellectual property, no matter how much you work on it. So I had this interesting conversation. They said, "Right, we've got sort of half a small sheet of some notes. Could you make a novel out of that?" And I went, "Well, you know, you're aware this has all been done before, but if I change this and change that and change the other and swap that around and change this character to that and introduce new character here, then it's something different." And they went, "Yeah, do that then." So that's what I ended up writing.
Wonderful. And it's already sold for a television.
Yes, indeed. I forgot to mention that. So presumably the guy hunted down the producer in the lift, who was quite impressed by this thing on the back of a beer mat, and said, "Oh, look, here's a manuscript." And they went, "Yeah, all right." So Warner Brothers Television have optioned it, and it does look likely to go ahead.
Fabulous. And now you know why it's called an elevator pitch. Alrighty. Anybody else got any questions for our two readers? Why is everybody... Why is everybody looking at Justin? I know he hasn't been here for a couple of months.
Good evening, everybody. Jonathan, I'm just impressed with your writing. I'm impressed by the research you must have done to get inside a psychopath's mind.
Thank you.
Incredibly. just how did you do it?
It's easy. I introduced him to Lauren Berkus.
Ever since I was a kid, I've had an interest in forensic science anyway. I've read an ungodly number of books, both about forensic science and forensic psychology. And when the whole Silence of the Lambs thing came in, tons of books were produced on that, and I read up that quite heavily. Contrary-wise, I found myself at first thinking, oh, serial killers, aren't they cool? After a while, I came to the conclusion, no, they're not in the slightest bit cool at all. They're ghastly people. They're thoroughly broken. And I was finding myself almost understanding them too well and really not liking what I saw. So I backed away from it. But the information's still there to be called upon.
By the way, all true serial killers plaster their walls with pages torn out of Neil Gaiman's Sandman. Alrighty. Any other questions for our readers?
It's actually for both of you, but where does the darkness really come from inside you?
Joe, it's getting back on all the people who annoy you at BristolCon, isn't it?
Yes, it could be due to running the BristolCon committee. Well, speaking as a sweet and lovely person who clearly has no outer darkness, all that inner darkness has to go somewhere. I know, it's just fun. It's just really, really fun to write something really, really, really horrible. It's more fun than writing about nice people.
Jonathan, how long have you been possessed?
I think it was the age of three, somewhere around there. It was an award-winning film from Czechoslovakia that did it, I seem to recall. It's always been there ever since I was a kid. One of the books in the house that fascinated me most was a very old copy of the Grimm's Fairy Tales. Big, thick thing. Its cover had long since fallen off, and it was full of woodcuts. And it, putting it that way, it does sound like something from the title sequence of a serial killer movie, doesn't it? And I was just fascinated by it. And when I was old enough to start reading, I read all the obvious ones. And then I started reading the not-obvious Grimm's Fairy Tales. And... yeah, the darkness puddles out from those a bit. So it's just... Yes, you can't have unending tales of goodness and niceness because it's just like standing in a desert. You need the shadow.
Any other questions? Justin?
I've thought a lot about, you know, serial killers and all these kinds of people and horrible people. It seems to me, you know, on a serious note, that The line that's drawn between criminal and insanity is too far towards insanity. In other words, people who are insane, like serial killers, should be put in mental hospitals, not in jails. And I just wonder what your considered opinion would be. Seriously.
There's... are psychological terms, which are psychiatric terms, which are out of favour now, but they're still useful, which is the difference between sociopath and psychopath and psychotic. Psychotic absolutely should be in some kind of institution. But sociopaths and, to a degree, psychopaths know they're doing wrong, and so they're committing a moral crime in what they do. So, yes, if somebody's psychotic... Psychotics don't tend to make serial killers simply because they're too disorganised. But sociopaths and psychopaths, they know what they're doing. They know what they're doing is beyond the pale, and they still do it, so what can you do?
Any more questions? General questions about BristolCon? Do we know anybody who's coming up at future BristolCon Fringe events?
The next Fringe, which is November the 4th, I can't remember. It's a long way in the future. It's about the, I don't know, if somebody can find out when the Mondays are, and it's about a month away. No, November the 15th is going to be Stephanie Burgess and Lucy Hounsom. And then in December, we've got Simon Cohen and Sarah Ash. Oh, thank you, John. 16th. Thank you, John. So that should be good.
And all the information about this is, of course, on bristolcon.org, which is our website. Mr. Sutton, have you got any announcements on behalf of the Festival of Literature? Loads of stuff.
So Bristol Festival of Literature, we're about halfway through now, which is why I'm so tired and bedraggled. So tomorrow there's a fantastic event in Redcliffe Caves, but unfortunately it's sold out. But if you turn up on the night, if we can squeeze you in, we will, but no guarantee of getting in. On Wednesday, myself, Kevlin and Tom will all be reading Down in Pinkworks at Carol Peace's studio, Peace's Inspired by Art. After that, there's a Jamaican poet coming up from London to read Word of Mouth. On Thursday night, it's Novel Night with Pat Ferguson talking about how to give your characters a distinctive voice. On Friday night, I should probably hand over to Kevin because he's stood next to me and he can tell you all about it.
Friday night, we've got the Flash Slam that's going to be at Crofters Writes on Stokes Croft. Five local writing groups, I think it actually works out as five and a half. We've ended up with a mashup of one of them, are going to be competing for the glory of being Bristol's best flash fiction writing and reading group. That's hosted by Nikesh Shukla. Should be an absolute blast. And at this point, I'm going to hand back to Pete.
And finally, to round up, on Saturday, we'll be having our sort of, we call it the Speakeasy, which has got a bit of a Jonathan Ross sort of feel to it, I guess. And there will be Tracy Alexander and Sarah Hillary. And Sarah Hillary is a local writer that started at The Flash with Kevlin and I and a few others. But she's since written some fantastic crime books and very dark. It is sort of horror crime, and she won the Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Award this year, so that's a good prize for a local writer.
I would just like to say, as we're podcasting, I would like to say congratulations to Lou Morgan in the guise of Maggie Harcourt, who has been nominated for the Carnegie Medal, and she's read at the Fringe before, so we're very pleased for her.
And one more thing worth mentioning in Bristol, the Sanctum event at Temple Church, which is going on for 21 days, is starting any day now. A lot of the performers there are going to be musicians and goodness knows what else. I was told today there's even going to be an archaeologist coming to talk about something or other. Goodness knows why or what, but there will be. Now, one of the rules of Sanctum is that you're not supposed to know who is going to be on when, so I can't tell you anything about exactly when people are going to be on, but I can tell you that there are going to be some wonderful people on, including Pete and Tom and Kevlin and Joe and Roz. Yep, and Emma Vanwee. So yeah, lots of good people, and also me. So I can't tell you on the podcast what date I'm going to be on, but if somebody wants to come up to me privately afterwards and ask, I'd be happy to slip you a little bit of paper that you have to destroy afterwards. Okay, so the other thing I have to tell you is that we have lots of lovely books for sale. We have copies of Jo's Spark and Carousel that she read from. We also have the two Art of Forgetting books that she told you about, also set in the same world. We have North by Southwest and Forgotten Heroes, which are both anthologies by local writers that Pete's put together. I think some of the authors in those are here. We have, of course, the awesome Airship Shape and Bristol Fashion. Steampunk stories set in Bristol by local authors, available in paperback and hardback. And we have the hardback editions of Colin Harvey's two fabulous science fiction novels. The hardbacks and the airships, they're all Wizards Tower books, and I've taken a lot off the price today. So £20 cover price, you can get them for £15 here. And if you want to buy the two Colin Harvey books, I'll let you have them for 25 for the pair. So I think that's about it, unless anybody has any other announcements. We can all get back to drinking. Oh, Joe has one more.
Sorry, one more. Next week, pub night in here on the Monday. I might not be there because I might be dead after FantasyCon, but this is where people will be on Monday.
And thank you and good night. Back to drinking.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.